Come right back. We're looking at beauty, truth, and wisdom that braid together. Anyone who's ever done braiding of three cords knows that you get a very strong cable or a nice bracelet or necklace. It's strong. The theoretic, the romantic, and the mystic. In philosophy, in the love of wisdom, the romantic is a way of having a transfield of consciousness through the prism of a person as the transform. It's a way of bringing myth through the symbolic structure of thought with the mythic horizon of themes and feelings and images and language. Bringing it through the structure of symbolic thought, almost as if, because now the structure of symbolic thought is not just an integral, but is spaced in such a way that its structure has lattices like a crystal. Or if it's done really on a high level, it's not a crystal, it's a jewel. Now the structure of symbolic thought is a jewel that scintillates when light is put into it and when the visionary energy of consciousness goes into it, it illuminates. It illuminates in such a way that the structure of symbolic thought is tuned to the artist of the spirit person. And the myth completes itself not by staying in the integral symbols of the mind, in ideas, for instance, or doctrines, or principles, or laws, or, you know, the rote. It goes through the mind as if the structure were a membrane now and not a special kind of a wall, and the special kind of a wall classically is that of a mirror. So that the closed mind has a great ability to reflect, but what it reflects is the phenomenality of the world, the ritual actions that have been selected out for being notable and noticed and arranged. And so the reflection of the mind is on things. It's on the body. It's on the actions of the body. It's on the karma. And in the ancient Parayana Sutra of the Anguttara Nikaya, the last of the classic eight questions to the Buddha includes a teaching saying that one must be alert not to cling to what you're holding onto. That actually is like an ape swinging through the trees, clinging to this branch and then clinging to that, that human beings are not apes swinging through the branches. They can stand and they can walk. One of the great yogis of the 20th century was Vinoba Bhave, and one of his really famous sayings, when you walk and do a yoga, it's called a yajna. And he was doing a huge yajna in the early 50s, and someone asked him why he was walking and walking and walking. He was called the walking saint. He said, walking is the correct pace of thinking. And I remember when I was 19 and starting to be the head porter at Sequoia National Park at Giant Forest Lodge, every other day was a day off, and I would go on long hikes. And when I built up stamina and musculature towards the end of the first year, I took a hike with an old Czech mountain man, and we hiked 50 miles in one day. It was a long way to go. What's interesting is that the ability to walk or to stand or to sit or to recline, all of these are postures then that not only are like a hatha yoga for the body, but they prepare the phenomenality of the postured body to step up the hatha yoga to a karma yoga, and then to step that up to a jnana yoga, and then to braid those three in a raja yoga. And classically, the raja yoga is the braiding of the first three together to make a wisdom tradition. What is being presented here is a maharaja yoga. Not to discipline the body, the phenomenality, the ritual actions, and just prepare it for a transform, but to prepare it for the transform of the transform. Our species came after a whole range of hominid species, and our original Homo sapiens mother, the first mutation, is a woman. She lived about 200,000 years ago in Africa. And it took 150,000 years for the first transform of the species Homo sapiens. And that transform happened about 50,000 years ago. And its transform was the ability to create art. There were no paintings, no sculpture, no music, no dancing in the world until about 50,000 years ago. And all of a sudden, the species became Homo sapiens sapiens. Not only a sapiens means wise, generally, but a species wise about being wise. They knew that now there is a transform for us here. We realize it's a dimension. It's the infinite field of consciousness as a dimension. It's not generally recognized yet, not even realized yet, not even a glimmer of realization, mostly, that it's a field which is a fifth dimension. And being a dimension, it has an uncanny effect on the four-dimensional space-time. It literally wakes up space-time for realization. And when a form emerges that does that, instead of being just a ritual-based character having experiences, or an integral individual having thought, now one is able to not just change or modify, but to transform through the trance field of consciousness. And that transform works both ways, because what enables the symbolic structure of thought to accept directed vision, the beauty of the composition that one is now going to live artfully. One is going to be an art as a work of art. One is going to create the art for the transforms. And in order to do this, the field of consciousness had to receive a gift from the world, from the mythic horizon of our character experience, from the structure of thought now become transparent enough to let the energies of experience go through it into the realm of possibility. And there, the mind gives up a structure of integration called the imagination. Doesn't give it all up, but gives up the capacity to have the imagination, the integration of images, the integration of feelings, not just tied to those images, but concomitantly a part of the quality which they are, and the language which carries them. Now, the field of consciousness has, from that gift, creative imagining. It becomes a process rather than a structure. In symbolic thought, it's a structure, an integral structure, the imagination. You can train the imagination. It's there as a structure. But in consciousness, it is a flow process that flows in that field. And because it flows in that field, because it's an infinity field, it is unencumbered, it is free. Not free form. Art is free form. The spirit person is a free form, is prismatic. But in receiving the gift of creative imagining, consciousness, because that quintessential dimension is cooperative and has a lot of love, gifts one of its processes called remembering to the symbolic structure, which now becomes the memory. And for the first time, the memory is linked in a do-si-do symbiosis with creative imagining and expands. The hunter who knew 500 different tracks and what the characteristics of the animals and the birds and so forth was, now expands the memory so that it by far exceeds the perimeters of ritual, of phenomena, of experience, and goes all the way back, because it's paired not only to the infinite presence, but is able to see futuristically and is able to see the past, the traditions and so forth, in an expanded way. So that the mind now, having an imagination and a memory and consciousness as a field, having the flow of remembering and the flow of creative imagining, the creative imagining becomes like the numerator over the denominator, the creative imagining over the remembering. And so art emphasizes the creative imagining. And the whole vision field becomes fertile for creativity. Balances out, because the prism of the person also has the capacity to have the remembering as the numerator. And that's where the process of history comes in. Art and history have a special kind of relationality. One of them is about creating. The other emphasizes remembering. But they are both dimensions in consciousness. So that consciousness has those three dimensions, a fifth dimension for vision, a sixth dimension for the artist, the spirit person, a seventh dimension for history. So history is not at all a chronicle. It's not a chronology. It has a seventh dimensional free form flow, which all of a sudden gives, in its kaleidoscopic way, the opportunity to discover the form of the cosmos. And that the form of the cosmos is very harmonic with our spirit persons, with the art of being a beautiful jewel that illumines the matrix, which then returns the light radiantly trillions of times. Our galaxy has about 400 billion stars. It's a part of a family of galaxies that has about 20 galaxies, two really big ones, ours and Andromeda, and about 18 smaller galaxies. And all of these, this entire entourage, moves together in the swirl of an arm of our Milky Way. And we can look across the zero, mostly zero gulf, to the next arm of the Milky Way, about 900 light years away. And the first conspicuous constellation there is Orion. This is how it is. Nowhere did you hear the word politics, or empire, or ego, etc. They do not occur. Not only are they not necessary, they don't exist. They're promoted appearances. The yogic story that was told about it is that something that is not real, when it is seen through, it simply not only doesn't occur anymore, it never did occur in the first place. It never really happened. It was all figment of fictitiousness. This is the fear that drives evil, that only not will it be conquered by good, but that enlightenment will see through it to its oblivion before it ever even occurred. No wonder it will cling to any opportunity to remain in business. It's going to be put out of business because there's no business. Any aliens watching this DVD, you need to make nice. That way you can stick around. Theoretic, romantic, and mystic. The far west was a seed of the romantic. The far east was a seed of the mystic. And Alexandria was a seed of the theoretic. And one of the qualities that was peculiar is the paradoxes that happen. The Holy Family, realizing that after the crucifixion, things were going to be difficult, and after the resurrection, things were going to be impossible, were sent as a gift, as an emissary to the far west, 37 AD. Thomas went to India the next year, 38 AD. and took with him the only gospel that was written at that time, and that was the Gospel of Matthew. We know this because about 130 some years later, in Alexandria, a very wise teacher named Panteus realized that there had been so much editing of books that were supposed to be gospels or letters or whatever, the proto-New Testament, were so heavily edited already that they were not trustworthy for the original. And so he went all the way to India to get a copy of the original Gospel of Matthew from southern India, from a city that we used to call Madras, now it's called Chennai in southern India. And there, still today in Chennai, in Madras, in a park, is a hill called St. Thomas Hill. The wonderful history of the Indian Christians of St. Thomas, an account of the ancient Syrian church of Malabar, published by Cambridge University Press a number of years ago. The important thing is that Thomas, St. Thomas, was a master carpenter, which meant he was an architect as well. And he was known because Jesus' father was a master carpenter, an architect as well. The brothers of Jesus were carpenters as well. They could all build. One thing that we know is that there exists today in Ephesus, where Mary Magdalene went to take the young Saint John. He was only 12 years old at the resurrection. He had another year to go, and usually you have male prepare you for your bar mitzvah, for your ability to read the Torah out loud, for your ability to understand what it says and to take your seat with the congregation. Mitzvah means witnessed. The son is witnessed to be a man now. The person that prepared St. John was Mary Magdalene, because she was the wisest of all of the people that Jesus had surrounding him. It's not generally recognized, but she wrote the Odes to Solomon, Odes of Solomon. Here's a short, this is the 13th of 42 Odes of Solomon. This is a translation into English by James Charlesworth, who is now at Princeton, originally was at Duke, who did the first really wonderful scholarly treatment of the Odes of Solomon after a hiatus of almost 50 years. The Odes of Solomon were alluded to in a book called Faith Wisdom, Pistis Sophia, which was bequeathed from an estate to the British Museum, and nobody paid any attention to it. This was in the 1700s, until a Danish minister took a look, and he realized that this was a very refined work, and it's largely an account of expositions, interpretations of certain sacred hymns. The Greek word for that interpretation is hermeneia. In the Gospel of Thomas, Thomas says, these are the words of the living Jesus. Whoever discovers the hermeneia of these words will not taste death, because death does not occur in the real. Death is a part of an appearance cycle. Well, we get later on to the Vajrayana, the whole 49 days of the bardo cycle is the progressive lessening of the radiance of the real and a sinking back into the ignorance of the cycle of appearance. That life is in a cycle of death, and therefore one has to live with trepidation because death is inevitable, whereas the good news is that one lives freely real because death is an illusion. And to believe in it is a delusion. Here's her words translated into English. Behold, the Lord is our mirror. Open your eyes and see them in him, and learn the manner of your face. Then declare praises to his spirit, and wipe the paint from your face, and love his holiness and put it on. Then you will be unblemished at all times with him. Hallelujah. Later we will come to see an incredible job of illusion that has been made to make Mary Magdalene some kind of reformed prostitute. The very last saying, in Greek they're called logions, logia, in the Gospel according to Thomas. Simon Peter said to them, "Let Mary go out from among us, because women are not worthy of the life." Jesus said, "See, I shall lead her, so that I will make her male, that she too may become a living spirit, resembling you males. For every woman who makes herself male will enter the kingdom of heaven." When the two tune, they don't become one. They experience the community of the infinity field, which makes no singularities of individuality of anything that is phenomenal, including gender. Elsewhere, Jesus says, because he was constantly being challenged by the tricky questions of those who were pre-Inquisition inquisitors, of a complicated story of a woman who had married seven times, and each time the husband died, when she went to heaven, whose wife will she be? And the response was, in heaven, we are not given or taken in marriage. The tuning is infinite. We don't need those arrangements. One of the great things is that the house that was built for her was built by two of the brothers of Jesus, Simon and Joseph. Joseph, named for their father, and Simon, a common name at the time. Mary Magdalene's father was Simon, and when he contracted leprosy, he was called Simon the Leper. That's why Lazarus, his son, had to take over the family business, which was in Tyre, and the big family house was moved from Magdala to Bethany. Bethel, Bethany. And a house was so large that we read in the Gospel according to John, at the raising of Lazarus, so many people were there, but still about 2 miles from the temple in Jerusalem to that house in Bethany. The house was crowded and there were scores and scores of people, so it was a very large estate. They were quite wealthy. They were wealthy in such a way that Mary Magdalene, when her father had to be moved because Bethany was next to the cemetery area and next to the leper colonies that were also there in that region of Mount of Olives, she was sent as a young girl to, under the care of her brother Lazarus in Tyre, and that's where she received a very special thing for girls at the time. She received one of the best educations in the world, because the Phoenician trade routes for thousands of years, refined by the Semitic genius traders for hundreds of years since Alexander the Great's time. The reason why many talented Jews accompanied Alexander from Judea especially to the nascent Alexandria, and they took his name as their last name, some of the earliest family, and that family name, Alexander, was exactly the name that Philo's brother had and his two nephews had. The family also participated in the success of Julius Caesar in the Alexandrian War. They financed a great deal of the relief troops that came, burying a lot of Jewish warriors, burying many mercenaries, and the money was put up largely by the Alexander family, so they were able to take middle names of Julius. And so you find a whole lineage of so-and-so Julius Alexander. The two sons of Philo's brother, the first one was named Marcus Julius Alexander, and he's the one that took over the family trade route with India. Not only to India, but it went through Ethiopia and Arabia to India. Not along the coast of Arabia and the coast of what is now Iran and Pakistan, but directly over from the Red Sea to the south of India. That's where the trade winds went, to the Malabar coast. The other son was born about 14 AD as Tiberius Caesar came into power after Augustus at age 77 died. So he was named Tiberius Julius Alexander. He was the general under Flavius Titus, and the two of them commanded the Roman troops that destroyed the temple in Jerusalem. Tiberius Julius Alexander became the governor of Egypt. His influence, not so much on a Judaism, but on a Judaism in transform to what was not yet Christianity, but was Jesus' way. The wife of Marcus Julius Alexander was a beautiful Jewish woman named Berenice. Her father became Herod Agrippa. Marcus died, and Berenice, because she was beautiful and wealthy, quickly went through two short marriages that just simply wouldn't work, and she became the mistress of Titus, whose father, Vespasian, founded the Flavian dynasty of Roman emperors, and Titus was the second, and he co-ruled with his father for most of that time, and for about 8 years, it was give or take that she was going to be a Jewish wife of the Roman emperor. Unfortunately, Titus died early, and his younger brother, Domitian, took over and slowly went insane. And towards the end of his reign, he reigned until 96 AD. In 95 AD, he became vicious, and it's known in Roman history as the Reign of Terror. It's in that Reign of Terror that he was insane over the powers of Jesus's way, and had St. John brought to Rome and was put into boiling oil. And when St. John would not injure or die, he became absolutely terrorized from the rebound of his own Reign of Terror, and he exiled St. John to the most symbolic, worst place he could think of, to the island of Patmos off the Ionian coast. Patmos is shaped like a ship, but it's a stone ship. It doesn't ever go anywhere. It was on Patmos that the old St. John wrote the book of Revelation. But Titus and Domitian had a sister named Domitia. And Domitia became a Christian. Not a Christian, church Christian, but a follower of Jesus' way. Her daughter was also named Domitia. And the first catacomb in Rome is the Catacomb of Domitia. This is the passage going down. And this is the beginning of the catacombs of Rome. We have to understand that the catacombs of Rome are a complex. The full length of them is more than 90 miles. It is a scrambled kind of a crystal with no lattice work, so that anyone going in who didn't know the way would never find it, because it was like a baffle. So that people could hide out, they could bury their dead, the sites could not be found, there were no street signs, no road signs. Every so often, a shaft, a light shaft, would be raised up, and that illumination would filter down. And we'll talk next week a little bit more about this. The difficulty is that there is such a convolution and such a puzzle and such a labyrinth. And for many people to even hear for the first time, they can't take it. Because it means that the recalibration that is now commencing vanishes the appearance of a fictitious past permanently. More next week.